This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Dr. Jill Stein, frontrunner for the Green Party nomination for President of the United States. Jill Stein is a mother, physician, longtime teacher of internal medicine, and pioneering environmental health advocate. She is the co-author of two widely praised reports, In Harm's Way, Toxic Threats to Child Development, and Environmental Threats to Healthy Aging. She has twice been elected to town meeting in Lexington, Massachusetts, and has run for governor, representative, and secretary of state in Massachusetts. In her 2006 race for secretary of state, she won the votes of over 350,000 Massachusetts citizens. Jill Stein is here today to tell us why she is running for president of the United States and what she hopes to accomplish. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Diane.
Why did you decide to run for president of the United States?
Specifically, the breaking point, I guess, for me was last year when the president put Medicare and Social Security on the chopping block as a solution to what was really a concocted crisis around the debt ceiling, a crisis we didn't need to have in the first place. And at that point, I said to myself, this cannot be allowed to go unchallenged. And I became active in the Green Party in ensuring that we would have a voice of opposition and that there would be a real challenge in the presidential election, not only to the dismantling of Social Security and Medicare, but to everything else that is under attack around us, from the people to the planet to our democracy, our civil liberties, and our economy, you know, really the whole nine yards. But for me, that was the breaking point, to see the incredible foundation of just and caring society to be under attack. And in the course of participating in the Green Party process to get somebody out there, I got recruited. So in short, that's how I came to be running. But as you know, I got into this originally maybe 20 years ago as a medical doctor and a mother, very concerned about what I was seeing in the clinic and in my community, the epidemics of chronic disease really that had descended on us, particularly on children, between the learning disabilities, autism, asthma, obesity, you name it, all these things that didn't used to be the problems that they are today. So the long and the short was I learned in the trenches that you can have solutions that are good for people, good for the planet, good for the economy, a win-win all around for health, environment, and jobs. And you can go, you know, on bended knee to your legislature or your Congress, but unless you've got a lot of money in hand, unless you're the Koch brothers or ALEC or, you know, something in that order, it doesn't count that having life-saving and money-saving solutions, unfortunately, is not what wins the day in our political system, which is basically driven by big money. So I learned kind of in the field over many years that if I wanted to help change our very broken healthcare system and the problems in the environment that drive it, our broken economy, our increasingly broken education system, that we have to first fix the broken political system in order to do it.
How do you see your experience contributing to your ability to govern?
In a big way. As a young woman said to me at a recent appearance, she said, "Oh my God, you're normal. I didn't know that they had politicians like you." And I think my experience of not being in the back rooms, of not being a creature of corporate-sponsored politics, I think that's exactly what we need and what Americans are really longing for, a real politics of integrity. And, you know, recent polls show that something like 49% of people are saying that we need a third party and they would seriously consider voting for it because it feels like the current political system is that corrupt. So I am quick to point out that the kind of experience that unfortunately taints most of politics, I'm really proud not to have. On the other hand, my experience as an activist, as a healthcare provider, as someone very concerned about health and the environment and creating an economy that runs in concert with that, that supports our health and the health of our communities and our planet. They can all work together. You know, I can put solutions on the table that people are really hungering for. So having worked to build basically democratic, on-the-ground grassroots movements to get some of the most toxic pesticides off the shelf, which was a national movement that removed chlorpyrifos, you may remember that, about 10 years ago, to have been part of cleaning up the coal plants, helping to lead that movement in my state, having helped lead the recent movement for redistricting, actually, in Massachusetts that doubled the seats representing communities of color. I have a lot of experience of the kind that we need, which is building the power of grassroots democracy to make our communities and our planet and our economy more just, green, and secure for the future.
What do you see as the most important issues currently facing our country?
There are so many. Like, let me count the ways. This political system, I guess, has just delivered crisis after crisis. And by that, I mean the political establishment, which is both Democratic and Republican. So you could say that the mother of all issues here, really, I think, is recovering our democracy so that we can do the right thing. When people ask me what kind of medicine I'm practicing, I usually say I'm practicing political medicine now because it's the mother of all illnesses. But let's move forward from there, you know, with that as a basic assumption that the biggest issue here is for people to stand up and actually reassert our democracy and reject the drumbeat that keeps telling us over and over that we have to be very afraid, that you cannot vote your values, you've got to vote your fears. I think the reality is that is the biggest issue. People have to get out from under the clutches of that mind control because, you know, the politics of fear has only brought us everything we're afraid of. That is, you know, the collapsing economy, the expanding war, the attack on our civil liberties, the turning of an entire generation of students into indentured servants with the student debt crisis. The politics of fear has given us everything we're afraid of. And in fact, we have to answer that politics of fear with the politics of courage. That's always what has driven the progressive agenda forward. It's always been a independent political party. At the time of abolition, it was the Liberty Party. At the time of women's suffrage, it was the Women's Party. For the advances of unionizing and decent jobs and the 40-hour work week and safe workplaces, it was the Socialist, the Labor, and the Progressive parties. They had the politics of courage and made history by working an alliance, basically, between social movements and independent political parties that changed history together. And we've got to do that again, and people need to reject this idea that you can't vote for your values. If you don't vote for your values, you're basically giving a mandate for 4 more years of the same. So I'd say that is the most overarching issue in front of us. But for the specifics, clearly it's transforming the economy so that it provides the jobs that we need, as well as the green economy that we need. We call that the Green New Deal, and essentially it would put 25 million people back to work who need full-time living wage jobs. But we would ensure that those jobs are community-based jobs that not only end the unemployment, they create the green economy on an emergency basis that we need and put a halt to climate change. And then I'll just add quickly, getting rid of student debt and making public higher education free. We wiped out the debt of the banks who caused the crash of the economy. If we could forgive the bankers, we can forgive the debt of the students who were the victims of that waste, fraud, and abuse. We can forgive student debt and ensure that public higher education is free as it should be. It's an incredible investment. It returns many times over on the dollar. We need to end the wars, bring the troops home from these illegal and immoral wars, downsize the military, and bring our troops back from the bases in over 140 countries around the world where we don't need to be, end the drone wars, and we need to move to a Medicare for all healthcare system that covers everybody comprehensively, restores choice to you, the consumer, instead of having an insurance company bureaucrat decide what your healthcare is going to be, and which also saves us actually trillions of dollars over the next decade. So these are win-win solutions that the American public wants. We just have to stand up and drive them forward.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Dr. Jill Stein, frontrunner for the Green Party nomination for President of the United States. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. You mentioned your Green New Deal. Could you just list the elements of that Green New Deal?
Sure. The Green New Deal covers the green economy, what we think of as traditionally as the green economy, but it also covers the social and economic areas of the economy, so that we say in the Green New Deal, communities decide what they need to make themselves sustainable economically, socially, and ecologically. So the big part is obviously the green ecological aspect of the sustainability, because that's what's totally new here. So we're talking about clean manufacturing, local organic agriculture, public transportation, as well as active forms of transportation like biking and safe sidewalks and all that. And then, of course, clean renewable energy, which has the added benefit of making wars for oil obsolete. Those are the broad areas. And in the social areas of the economy, it's the things that we need in order to be socially sustainable and just communities: teachers, nurses, child care, elder care, substance abuse prevention and rehabilitation, affordable housing, etc. So it's a whole mix of jobs at the community level that jumpstart our economies as they relocalize them and meet the fundamental things that we need in order to be sustainable and have a just economy.
Would you now say more about your view of our healthcare system and whether you are in favor of the new healthcare law that the Obama administration has put into place?
Yes. You know, as a doctor living in the state where this program has been piloted, I have a fairly up-close and personal experience of this law. And what I can tell you is that the law helped some people, it hurt some people, and in the end, it has allowed the cost of healthcare to skyrocket into basically self-destruction. We have a healthcare system here in Massachusetts that's also under a kind of self-destruct mode, and it has not changed at all medical bankruptcies here, so that at the end of the day, you're not insured. You have a piece of paper, but that piece of paper has enormous holes in it. So when you truly get sick, it's great if you're not sick. But if you're sick, neither your health nor your financial security are truly protected. It's clear we need to move to a real solution, that is, to a Medicare for All system, also called a single payer. It's like Medicare, except the age of eligibility is dropped to basically the moment of conception, so that everyone gets covered all the time. And the excuse used not to go there is that, oh my God, it's just not politically feasible. Well, the reason for that is because look who's running Congress and the White House, you know, the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies. That's why it's not politically feasible. So let's make it politically feasible by electing people who are not creatures of that corporate-sponsored politics, that is, Green Party people like myself. And the other big reason offered against Medicare for All is that it would cost too much. And in fact, it's exactly the opposite. Under Medicare for All, you save a huge amount of money, which right now is poured into this massive private health insurance bureaucracy. It's 30% of every dollar. So that all gets channeled right back into healthcare rather than paper pushing under a single payer system. That's why we can afford to cover everybody. And over time, you save trillions of dollars because medical inflation, the rising cost, actually pretty much goes away. It stabilizes under a single payer system. And then the final thing I should add is that the big elephant in the room on healthcare is that 75% of our healthcare dollars are actually spent on chronic diseases that are rather completely avoidable if we do the right thing up front. These are preventable diseases that can be prevented at the community level. How? Basically, by doing what your mother says, which is, you know, having a healthy food supply, a healthy and affordable food supply, which is accessible, and having an active transportation system so that activity is built into our communities, and by doing pollution prevention, because things like air pollution and the bisphenol A in our canned food and things like that, these are real drivers of chronic disease as well. So by creating green jobs, and this goes back to the Green New Deal, by moving to a green economy, we get exactly that. We ensure that everybody has access to a healthy, fresh, local, organic food supply. It's a priority of the green economy. that you can bike and walk to work. In Copenhagen, 40% of people do that. We should be able to do that too. Kids should be able to walk to school. Exercise should be integrated into our lives. And we can do pollution prevention by moving to the green forms of energy, obviously. So it's a win-win-win to move to the green economy. It creates the foundation of a healthcare system so that we can actually be healthy and afford it and have jobs at the same time.
Well, you've alluded to this, but what are the specific steps you would take to address climate change?
Great question, because it is so urgent. I would do many things. So for one thing, moving to the green economy is very critical, because then we have just a whole new ball game, and the economy at the end of the day is really the driver. In addition, we need to prioritize an international agreement. This was the agreement at Durban that the White House basically scuttled. I would initiate a Durban 2 so that we could get back to the drawing board and create that binding international agreement to draw down on carbon urgently, I should say. This really is an emergency. I would instruct the EPA to use all the resources and power that it has to ensure that we are not creating new destructive forms of energy and new facilities as well, so that we would not develop fracking. We would create a nationwide ban, actually, on fracking. We would not open up our offshore fragile areas and the Arctic and our national parks to mining and drilling. The components of the president's policy, which are so terribly destructive, I would instruct the EPA to basically do the opposite. I would put an end to further mountaintop removal. I would instruct the EPA to truly regulate coal. We need to begin decommissioning those dirty and dangerous coal plants, as we need to begin decommissioning our nuclear power plants. This president is building more of each. We need to actually begin moving expeditiously in the opposite direction, and that is certainly what I would do. And one other thing I would do on day one, which is to take the Monsanto appointments out of the White House and out of our agencies. This president appointed Monsanto lobbyists to important positions in the FDA, which is just outrageous, and big Monsanto boosters in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I should include, by the way, in my instructions to EPA would also be that science should be used here to actually protect the public on the matter of genetically modified foods. And, you know, there should be a ban until such time that GMOs can be assured to be environmentally safe and safe for our health. We do not have a means of assuring the safety of these substances, so they should be under an indefinite moratorium right now. There's one other thing I should add, which again is a mix of climate and health, and that is on the subject of marijuana and hemp. I would instruct the Department of Justice, for one thing, to stop interfering in states that have already begun to legalize marijuana, to decriminalize it, and to legalize medical marijuana. This is both a matter of health in the case of medical marijuana. It's a matter of environment, because hemp is a very important not only food source, but also important for the green economy. It is a substance, you know, out of which you can manufacture virtually everything from paper to jewelry, diapers, and car parts. I mean, it's an incredible potential for food and fiber, and potentially also for biofuels that needs to be explored. It can be grown with minimal water inputs and does not need fertilizers and pesticides as well. So it's a very important resource for sustainable agriculture and local economies. So I would include that in the agenda, likewise for protecting our climate. And of course, the war on drugs is failed and drives the demonization of African American men and has been used to imprison, to incarcerate predominantly African Americans and people of color and Latinos. So it's been implemented in an incredibly unjust and racist way and contributes to the ongoing problems of racial inequality and racial profiling. So we need to take a first step towards ending this failed war on drugs by taking marijuana and hemp off the list of scheduled substances, which is what science would argue. Science should be used as the basis for scheduling substances, that is, making them illegal. There should be a scientific basis for it. There is currently not.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Dr. Jill Stein, frontrunner for the Green Party nomination for President of the United States. One of your quotes is that we don't need to run America like a business or like the military. We need to run America like a democracy. What are the best steps to take to run America more like a democracy?
Very good question. Yes, to run America like a democracy, there are many things we can do to move ourselves in that direction. Some can be done very quickly. Some can be done over a longer period of time. So to quickly, for example, the president could tell the FCC that we need to start using our airwaves in the public interest. These are still public airwaves, and we could require free airtime for qualified candidates. Once you do that, the costs of running political campaigns plummet. You pull the rug out from under them. Politics becomes affordable for everyday people who are not corporate sponsored, and having millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars to spend ceases to become such a definitive advantage, which it is right now because the big cost of campaigns is getting on the air and informing people about your campaign. So that's one thing that could be done right away, is to bring back free airtime. We clearly need to move to get money out of politics more definitively through public financing of campaigns, by restricting lobbyist contributions, and also by restricting the ability of elected officials to recycle themselves as proponents for lobbyists. There needs to be an end to the revolving door. That is something that can be instituted fairly simply and straightforwardly as well. We need to put an end to corporate personhood. That requires a constitutional amendment, but that is doable because the American people certainly are not happy campers under what we're getting right now. We need to give the rights of personhood back to people for whom they were intended by the Constitution. It was never intended that corporations would have the rights of human beings. And we need to ensure that our right to vote is sacrosanct, that voter ID laws should not even be a possibility. We need a constitutional right to vote that ensures that everyone has the right to vote and make it easier and more convenient to do so. We need to ensure that our votes have integrity with hand-marked paper ballots rather than these electronic voting systems that can be wired from the inside. And we need to vote within voting systems that actually give our vote meaning. We need to abolish the Electoral College and implement a ranked choice voting system that actually lets you rank your choices so you don't have to worry about your vote inadvertently helping someone you don't want to help. You get to put your first choice first. If it's an underdog and the underdog loses, your vote is then reassigned to your second choice. It's a no-brainer system. It's in use in many countries around the world and many cities around this nation. We can do that, and we can also move to proportional representation that ensures that if the Green Party is 20% of the vote, then we get 20% of the representatives in Congress. It ensures that your vote has meaning and truly counts. So it's not rocket science about how to take our democracy back. It's just having the courage to stand up and insist that it happen, and that it happen now, because the clock is ticking.
Traditionally, third-party candidates, or so-called third-party candidates, only gain a small percentage of the vote. What do you hope your candidacy will accomplish?
You know, I think our campaign can accomplish great things. And all bets are off on what it will be. You know, the odds are certainly not in our favor that we are going to turn the White House into a greenhouse this election. But on the other hand, the odds were certainly not in favor of those young people who got out in Tahrir Square and basically dismantled a dictatorship that had been entrenched for 40 years, that was much more entrenched than our political system, in some ways at least. And same thing in Tunisia. You know, these were just people who saw that there is no future in the direction that we're going. And they took that very seriously because these are young people. And they are constitutionally very empowered to make change, as people tried to do in 2008 and discovered it wasn't going to happen within this corporate-sponsored political system. I think people are waking up in droves now to see that we really need that change more desperately than ever, and it's got to happen from outside of the two-party corporate system. So I would say all bets are off. What will happen? We've got a confluence right now of a declining economy, a declining environment, the attack on our civil liberties, incredible disparities of wealth. We're continuing to bail out the banks while one out of every two families in America is either in poverty or close to it. Young people are taking this very seriously. They're up to their eyeballs in debt and can't get jobs to pay that debt back. You know, I met a young man yesterday who was waiting on tables to repay $70,000 in loans for a college and a master's degree. He's still waiting on tables, you know, just now to service his loans, and that's about all he can get in this economy. And that story is, I'm afraid, it's just all too common. So people are taking this really seriously, that we badly need change. And if we were to go viral about that, you know, there are enough students out there, there are enough proponents of saving the climate, there are enough working people who are just not getting by on minimum wage jobs, which are the jobs that are coming back now in this so-called economic recovery that we're having. It's a minimum wage recovery. There are enough people out there that get it, that if we were to go viral, we could turn the White House into a greenhouse. But barring that, whatever we get, I think, moves us in the right direction, and it's a win. In my view, it's a win, whether it's 2% or 52%. It is a win simply to recover our voice, the voice of democracy. Without us, it is a corporate voice. It's not a voice of democracy. By us, I mean, you know, sort of people-powered third parties, the Green Party or other people-powered independent politics, that we can make a huge leap forward in this election simply by standing up and insisting that we take our future back, and by making our voices heard. By making our voices heard, we help drive these solutions into the agenda and make them unstoppable.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would just, you know, encourage people to go to my website, which is jillstein.org, and join the team, because, you know, this is an unprecedented crisis and an unprecedented opportunity to turn it all around. In some ways, you could say we're losing it all, but we could have it all, because a Green New Deal that fixes the economy, the environment, and our health truly brings it all back. And that's just, how can you question what to do in this position? Lose it all, have it all. Which would you prefer? You know, it's really clear that if we stand up in this election, we can make this a tipping point. Or I should say, we can change a breaking point into a tipping point and take back this promise of our democracy and a peaceful, just, green future that really is within our reach if we start standing up for it now.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Diane. Great talking with you.
You have just been listening to Dr. Jill Stein, frontrunner for the Green Party nomination for President of the United States. For more information, check on the web at www.jillstein.org. Again, that's jillstein.org. There will be an open house for Jill Stein in Seattle on Saturday, May 5th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Seattle Labor Temple, 2800 First Avenue between Clay and Broad Street. The public is invited to attend. Jill Stein will also speak on Monday, May 7th at 7:30 p.m. at University Temple Methodist Church, 14th and Northeast 43rd Street in the University District. For more information, go to gp-wa.us. Again, that's gp-wa.us. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.